That was always a possibility, always a risk. History shows that every age has some unquestioned neurosis, and Master Palamon had taught me that clemency is ours, a way of saying that one less one is more than nothing, that since human law need not be self-consistent, justice need not be so either. There's a dialogue in the Brown Book somewhere between two Misties in which one argues that culture was an outgrowth of the vision of the Increate as logical and just, bound by interior consistency to fulfill his promises and threats. If that was the case, I thought, surely we will perish now, and the invasion from the north that so many have died to resist is no more than the wind that topples a tree already rotten. Justice is a high thing, and that night, when I lay beside Dorcas listening to the rain, I was young, so that I desired high things only. That, I think, was why I so desired that our guild regain the position and regard it had once possessed. And I still desired that, even then, when I had been cast out of it. Perhaps it was for the same reason that the love of living things, which I had felt so strongly as a child, had declined until it was hardly more than a memory, when I found poor Triskele bleeding outside the Bear Tower. Life, after all, is not a high thing, and in many ways is the reverse of purity. I am wise now, if not much older, and I know it is better to have all things high and low than to have the high only. Unless the Chiliarch decided then to grant clemency, tomorrow I would take Aegilus's life. No one can say what that means. The body is a colony of cells, I used to think of our oubliette when Master Palamon said that. Divided into two major parts, it perishes. But there is no reason to mourn the destruction of a colony of cells. Such a colony dies each time a loaf of bread goes into the oven. If a man is no more than such a colony, a man is nothing. But we know instinctively that a man is more. What happens then to that part that is more? It may be that it perishes as well, though more slowly. There are a great many haunted buildings, tunnels, and bridges, yet I have heard that in those cases in which the spirit is that of a human being and not an elemental, its appearances grow less and less frequent, and at last cease. Historiographers say that in the remote past men knew only this one world of Uurth, and had no fear of such beasts as were on it then, and traveled freely from this continent to the north. But no one has ever seen even the ghosts of such men. It may be that it perishes at once, or that it wanders among the constellations. This Uurth surely is less than a village in the immensity of the universe. And if a man lives in a village and his neighbors burn his house, he leaves the place if he does not die in it. But then we must ask how he came. Master Gerlose, who has performed a great many executions, used to say that only a fool worried about making some failure of ritual, slipping in the blood, or failing to perceive that the client wore a wig and attempting to lift the head by the hair. The greater dangers were a loss of nerve that would make one's arms tremble and give an awkward blow and a feeling of vindictiveness that would transform the act of justice into mere revenge. Before I slept again, I tried to steel myself against both. Chapter 31. The Shadow of the Torturer. It is a part of our office to stand uncloaked, masked, sword bared, upon the scaffold for a long time before the client is brought out. Some say this is to symbolize the unsleeping omnipresence of justice, but I believe the real reason is to give the crowd a focus and the feeling that something is about to take place. A crowd is not the sum of the individuals who compose it. Rather, it is a species of animal, without language or real consciousness, born when they gather, dying when they depart. Before the Hall of Justice, a ring of Demarchi surrounded the scaffold with their lances, and the pistol their officer carried could, I suppose, have killed 50 or 60 before someone could snatch it from him and knock him to the cobblestones to die. Still, it is better to have a focus and some open symbol of power. The people who had come to see the execution were by no means all, or even mostly, poor. The sanguinary field is near one of the better quarters of the city, and I saw plenty of red and yellow silk and faces that had been washed with scented soap that morning. Dorcas and I had splashed ourselves at the well in the courtyard. Such people are much slower to violence than the poor, but once roused are far more dangerous, because they are not accustomed to being overawed by force, and despite the demagogues, have a good deal more courage. And so I stood with my hands resting on the quillions of Terminus Est, and turned this way and that, and adjusted the block so that my shadow would fall across it. The Chiliarch was not visible, though I discovered later that he was watching from a window. I looked for Asia in the crowd, but could not find her. Dorcas was on the steps of the Hall of Justice, a position reserved for her at my request by the Portreeve. The fat man who had waylaid me the day before was as near the scaffold as he could get, with a lance fire threatening his bulging coat. The woman of the hungry eyes was on his right, and the gray-haired woman on his left. I had her handkerchief in my boot top. The short man who had given me an assimi and the dull-eyed man who stammered and talked so strangely were nowhere to be seen. I looked for them on the rooftops where they could have had a good view despite their small stature, and though I did not find them, perhaps they were there. Four sergeants in high-dress helmets led Aegilus forth. I saw the crowd opening for them like the water behind Hildegrin's boat before I could see them at all. Then came the scarlet plumes, then the flash of armor, and at last Aegilus's brown hair and his wide, boyish face held up tilted because the chains that bound his arms forced his shoulder blades together. I remembered how elegant he had looked in the armor of a guard's officer, with a golden chimera splashed across his chest. It seemed tragic that he could not be accompanied now by men of the unit that had in some sense been his, instead of these scarred regulars in laboriously polished steel. He had been stripped of all his finery now, and I waited to receive him wearing the Fullagen mask in which I had fought him. Silly old women believe the Panjudicator punishes us with defeats and rewards us with victory. I felt I had been given more reward than I desired. A few moments later he mounted the scaffold, and the brief ceremony began. When it was over, the soldiers forced him to his knees, and I lifted my sword, forever blotting out the sun. When the blade is as sharp as it should be, and the stroke is given correctly, one feels only a slight hesitation as the spinal column parts, then the solid bite of the edge into the block. I would take an oath that I smelled Aegilus's blood on the rain-washed air before his head banged into the basket. The crowd drew back, then surged forward against the leveled lances. I heard the fat man's exhalation distinctly, precisely the sound he might have made at climax when he sweated over some hired woman. From far away came a scream, Aegir's voice, as unmistakable as a face seen by lightning. Something in its timbre made me feel she had not been watching at all, but had known nevertheless when her twin died. The aftermath is often more troublesome than the act itself. As soon as the head has been exhibited to the crowd, it can be dropped back into the basket. But the headless body, which remains capable of losing a good deal of blood for a long time after the action of the heart has ceased, must be taken away in a manner dignified yet dishonorable. Furthermore, it must not be just taken away, but taken to some specific spot where it will be safe from molestation. An exultant can, by custom, be laid across the saddle of his own destrier, and his remains are surrendered to his family at once. Persons of lesser rank, however, must be provided with some resting place secure from the eaters of the dead, and at least until they are safely out of sight, they must be dragged. The executioner cannot perform this task because he is already burdened with a head and with his weapon, and it is rare for anyone else involved, soldiers, officers of the court, and so on, to be willing to do so. At the citadel, it was done by two journeymen and thus presented no difficulty. The Chiliarch, a cavalryman by training and no doubt by inclination, had solved the problem by ordering that the body should be pulled behind a baggage sumpter. The animal had not been consulted, however, and being more of the laborer than the warrior kind, took fright at the blood and tried to bolt. We had an interesting time of it before we were able to get poor Aegilus into a quadrangle from which the public was excluded. I was cleaning off my boots when the Portreeve met me there. When I saw him, I supposed he had come to give me my fee, but he indicated that the Chiliarch wished to pay me himself. As I told him, it was an unexpected honor. "He watched everything," the Portreeve said, "and he was quite pleased. He instructed me to tell you that you and the woman who travels with you are welcome to spend the night here if you wish.
We'll leave at twilight, I told him. I believe that will be safer. He took thought for a moment, then nodded, showing more intelligence than I would have anticipated.
The miscreant will have a family, I suppose, and friends, though no doubt you know more of them than I. Still, it's a difficulty you must face frequently.
I have been warned by more experienced members of my guild, I said.
I had said that we would leave at twilight, but in the event we waited until it was fully dark, in part for safety's sake, and in part because it seemed wise to eat the evening meal before we left. We could not, of course, make directly for the wall and Thrax. The gate, of whose location I had only a vague idea, in any event, would be shut, and I had been told by everyone that there were no inns between the barracks and the wall. What we had to do, then, was first to lose ourselves, and then to find a place where we could spend the night and from which we could go without difficulty to the gate the next day. I had gotten detailed directions from the Portreeve, and though we missed our way, it was some time before we realized it, and we began our walk quite cheerfully. The Chiliarch had tried to hand me my fee instead of casting it on the ground at my feet, as is customary, and I had had to dissuade him for the sake of his own reputation. I gave Dorcas a detailed account of this incident, which had amused me nearly as much as it had flattered me. When I had finished, she asked practically,
"He paid you well, then, I suppose?"
"More than twice what he should have given for the services of a single journeyman. A master's fee. And, of course, I got a few tips in connection with the ceremony. Do you know, despite all I spent while Aegir was with me, I have more money now than I did when I left our tower? I'm beginning to think that by practicing the mystery of our guild while you and I are traveling, I'll be able to support us."
Dorcas seemed to draw the brown mantle closer about her.
"I was hoping you wouldn't have to practice it again at all. At least not for a long time. You were so ill afterward, and I don't blame you."
"It was only nerves. I was afraid that something would go wrong."
"You pitied him. I know you did."
"I suppose so. He was Aegir's brother, and like her, I think, in everything except sex."
"You miss Aegir, don't you? Did you like her so much?"
"I only knew her for a day, much less time than I have known you already. If she had had her way, I'd be dead now. One of those two Averns would have been the end of me."
"But the leaf didn't kill you."
I still recall the tone she used when she told me that. Indeed, if I close my eyes now, I can hear her voice again and renew the shock I felt as I realized that ever since I had sat up to see Aegilus still grasping his plant, I had been avoiding the thought. The leaf had not killed me. But I had turned my mind from my survival just as a man suffering from a deadly sickness manages by a thousand tricks never to look at death squarely, or rather as a woman alone in a large house refrains from looking into mirrors and instead busies herself with trivial errands so that she may catch no glimpse of the thing whose feet she hears at times on the stairs. I had survived, and I should be dead. I was haunted by my own life. I thrust one hand into my cloak and stroked my flesh, gingerly at first. There was something like a scar, and a little caked blood still adhered to the skin, but there was no bleeding and no pain.
"They don't kill," I said. "That's all."
"She said they did."
"She told a great many lies."
We were mounting a gentle hill, bathed in pale green moonlight. Ahead of us, seeming as mountains do to be nearer than it was or could possibly be, was the pitch-black line of the wall. Behind us, the lights of Nessus created a false dawn that died bit by bit as the night advanced. I stopped at the top of the hill to admire them, and Dorcas took my arm.
"So many homes. How many people are there in the city?"
"No one knows."
"And we will be leaving them all behind. Is it far to Thrax, Severian?"
"A long way, as I've told you already. At the foot of the first cataract. I'm not compelling you to go, you know that."
"I want to. But suppose, Severian, just suppose I wanted to go back later. Would you try and stop me?"
I said, "It would be dangerous for you to try to make the trip alone, so I might try to persuade you not to. But I wouldn't bind or imprison you, if that's what you mean."
"You told me you'd written out a copy of the note someone left for me in that inn, do you remember? But you never showed it to me. I'd like to see it now."
"I told you exactly what it said, and it's not the real note, you know. Aegir threw that away. I'm sure she thought that someone, Hildegrin perhaps, was trying to warn me."
I had already opened by Sabretash. As I grasped the note, my fingers touched something else as well, something cold and strangely shaped. Dorcas saw my expression and asked,
"What is it?"
I drew it out. It was larger than aura chalk, but not by much, and only a trifle thicker. The cold material, whatever it was, flashed celestine beams back at the frigid rays of the moon. I felt I held a beacon that could be seen all over the city, and I thrust it back and dropped the closure of my sabretash. Dorcas was clasping my arm so tightly that she might have been a bracelet of ivory and gold, grown woman-sized.
"What was that?"
she whispered. I shook my head to clear my thoughts. "It isn't mine. I didn't even know I had it. A gem, a precious stone."
"It couldn't be. Didn't you feel the warmth? Look at your sword there. That's a gem. But what was that thing you just took out?"
I looked at the dark opal on the pommel of Terminus Est. It glowed in the moonlight, but it was no more like the object I had drawn from my sabretash than a lady's glass is like the sun. "The claw of the conciliator," I said. "Aegia put it there. She must have, when we broke the altar, so it would not be found on her person if she were searched. She and Aegilus would have got it again when Aegilus claimed victor right. And when I didn't die, she tried to steal it in his cell." Dorcas was no longer staring at me. Her face was lifted and turned toward the city in the sky glow of its myriad lamps.
"Severian," she said, "it can't be."
Hanging over the city like a flying mountain in a dream was an enormous building. A building with towers and buttresses and an arched roof. Crimson light poured from its windows. I tried to speak, to deny the miracle even as I saw it, but before I could frame a syllable, the building had vanished like a bubble in a fountain, leaving only a cascade of sparks.
Chapter 32. The Play. It was only after the vision of that great building hanging, then vanishing, above the city, that I knew I had come to love Dorcas.